I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a county jail in the antebellum South here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And back with us again, Brian Cogman. So good to have you. Always.
Hello, Brian. Hello, gentlemen.
This is
huge. Our final 99.
It's our final 99.
It is.
Thrilled that we were able to find something for you to come back on the 99 for, because you and I have been emailing back and forth about the stems and seeds that have existed at the bottom of this list. And then this movie popped up.
I'm not surprised, which we were kind of saving it
for someone. And it kind of didn't work out. I mean, it's Altman.
I should also say,
yeah, I mean, we were trying to get Altman on and we found out he died.
Some strong smelling. So,
right.
Yeah.
Like, wait a minute.
You're telling me he's dead?
Liv Tyler wasn't available.
But I'll be honest,
pinch hitting for Liv Tyler.
I usually lie on this podcast and claim I know everything, but I have to be honest. I don't know a lot about Altman. I mean, I know a lot about Altman.
Interesting.
Because I know a lot about film history.
Sure.
But I am less of a movie watcher than a film historian, which is to say,
love a narrative.
As I was looking, and I did this recently where I'm like, God, my Altman watching history is spotty.
So you haven't seen a lot of them necessarily, is what you mean.
I haven't seen a third of his films, right? I mean, I've seen enough to do a top five that I'm not embarrassed
by.
I have not seen, as I said, if there are like 8 70s movies that are like, you know, held as classics, I think I've seen 2.
I have some holes in my early.
So I'm not thrilled about that.
Well, because I think, I mean, I can only obviously speak for myself, but I Altman came to my awareness with The Player. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, I was 12, it was 92, and I remember really loving that movie, feeling like I quote unquote understood Hollywood because I saw The Player, right? Like it was probably my first like inside baseball movie. And mine too. And then I kind of watched all his stuff really from that point on, but I have not gone back as much as I should. So like I have some big holes, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller's A Big Hole. I have the Criterion on my coffee table. I have yet to watch it. That's a big gap for me. Nashville is a big gap for
me. Oh, you never seen Nashville?
I know.
That's what I've got.
Right. Okay.
Oh my goodness.
Nashville, like, I got.
Seen The Long Goodbye. You know what I mean?
I haven't seen that. That one I don't get.
Yeah. So like there's some
that
gaps.
One, and I felt like gaps. that's a Cogman classic right there.
The Long Goodbye. Great.
Sure.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean my big blind spots, and I said this to you.
Yeah.
Phil, it's Brewster McCloud.
Yes, which I've
McCain.
I've never seen Brewster McCloud.
Yeah. MASH.
Wow.
Long Goodbye.
Yeah.
There might be another one or two. But I've seen, and there are other ones that I haven't seen that I don't know.
Predator is probably a gap for most people.
I've seen Predator.
Oh, you have?
Okay. But it's not going to make my list. But
that's a terrible movie.
Okay.
Well, he's interesting in that he makes bad movies.
Sure. He's one of those geniuses that when they fail,
he misses, right?
But it's a big swing.
Just real fast, I'm going to run down his 70s because it seems like his feature career really started with MASH in 1970. So it's MASH, Brewster McCloud, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Images, which I don't know anything about, The Long Goodbye, Thieves Like Us, which I haven't seen, California Split, and Nashville, which I have seen, both of those, Buffalo Bill, Three Women, which I think people like, but I haven't seen, A Wedding, which I think people like, which I haven't seen, Quintet, which I think people like.
People like Quintet,
seen.
Yeah.
And
that's
then,
polarizing, but yeah, but those who like it love it. It's a weird movie. Yeah,
and then A Perfect
That's
Couple.
A sci-fi movie, right? Quintet.
Yeah, it's like an apocalyptic sort of. Paul Newman's in it. It's very strange.
And then it seems like he does Popeye, and then
He goes through a period. So he went through a period after the big bomb of there was a sort of twin bombs of Health and Popeye.
Yep.
That where he kind of left the A game and just said I'm going to make movies out of great plays. So for most of the 80s. He made movies out of plays, some of which were very sort of stage bound, simple movies.
Secret Honor is kind of a famous one.
Yeah, yeah. Secret Honor. That's the one that he went and shot like at the University of Michigan with their student crew. You know, it was sort of an interesting. It's considered, I guess, the wilderness years for him. Although there's some interesting movies in there. I think per your point, player kind of put him back on the A-list.
I mean, Tanner 88, was a miniseries so Tanner 88, I mean, look, it's there are these directors who do take these little sojourns into TV before it was hip. I mean, famously Lynch did it. And I think Altman does it with Tanner 88, which is a very Altman-y type
is that HBO?
Idea. I think it was
early HBO.
I feel like it was too.
Or Showtime or something. Yeah.
It is interesting to sort of like, I mean, people speak relatively highly of Vincent and Leo, which is in 90, which is the
Vincent
Van Gogh.
Theo. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which I think is interesting. And then he does he's very open about the fact that he did The Player to be able to make Shortcuts. Like that was really Shortcuts was the passion project he really wanted to get made. The Player is a hit. It allows him to do Shortcuts. He thinks that Predator Porte is going to be a hit. It's obviously not. It's just, and then he has this sort of ultimately this late career masterpiece in Gosford Park. Really kind of everyone, kind of assumed that, probably gonna win the Oscar for this. It's a long illustrious.
No one thought that, but it was amazing it got nominated.
I don't know about that. I think
it was a big hit.
People definitely loved it, but
I'm not saying that there was ever a moment when Ron Howard wasn't most likely the guy, but I just mean in the sense that Altman, it was sort of this moment of, are the Oscars going to give it to Altman for the career that he has had?
Oh yeah.
Because he made this great movie that very Academy friendly.
That doesn't happen very often. That only really happened with one director. Martin Scorsese made this movie, The Departed, which sucks. And they just gave him.
He made a great.
Then they just gave him an Oscar for no reason.
I mean, he made
I do just want to. I just want to say this. Someday we will do our someday in the future, we will have a one-off Departed episode where we can just
release a Departed.
I'll just release a Departed episode.
We'll just release it. We'll get Brian and Liz Hannah. I love
it'll be, it'll be amazing.
Well, I remember Kenny putting the call out to get people who hated it on your side. And crickets.
He has crickets. People that he has some.
No.
Definitely.
First of all, by the way. I like the crickets, Brian. I want the crickets.
The man likes to eat. He likes to eat crickets.
I think you know me and know me well enough to know now.
Would embolden you.
I love being. Yeah, you know the beginning of Fargo, the show with the poster that he runs his head into.
Yes.
With the one fish going that way and the other fish going that way, and the question: What if you're right?
I do
just want to say though, because I do think that to get back to Altman for a second, because I do think that please. he was a very anti-establishment filmmaker. I mean, in the 70s, he was really sort of a going in doing things that no one had done before. The biggest sort of, I would say, arguably his legacy, his lasting impact on the format of filmmaking is the voices, the cacophony of, Nashville was, I have not seen it, admittedly, but it was sort of the first time that you had this massive ensemble of people talking over each other. This idea
you should
of
watch
an audience
it today.
I might watch it today. I probably won't, but I might. Because I have movies to watch. But I do think that for this podcast, I think that was one of those things that really kind of changed the way dialogue was recorded and the way that dialogue was disseminated to an audience, where he was not, he didn't care so much if you got every line of dialogue. He wanted you to sort of have to fight to pick apart what was going on, a mosaic of sound and voices and what have you, which I think is fascinating. But it sometimes can be fucking frustrating too, right? Like you're trying to parse together what is important and what's not. And I think for him, he was like, real life is like this, right? Like if you're in a room filled with people, you've got a whole bunch of voices coming at you and you're trying to figure out, what stuff to pay attention to. I mean, I think that, and also the way he shoots his films, the cinematography, the slow zooms on things that he wants you to notice, that I love. There's one in this early on when Willis drops his flask or drops the bottle of booze and the camera zooms in on the bottle and pulls back out. Like I love that the camera for him is definitely a character.
Well, yeah. And I think, everything you just said is true. I think to sort of build upon that, the process by which he made movies was sort of, if not revolutionary, very, very unique to him. It was why I think a lot of actors really enjoyed working with him, because he would sort of stage these scenes and he would have a script, but then kind of give it a loose sort of improvisational feel where he's capturing behavior. And then it's very much, it's very much composed and edited and for the final product. But from what I gather, the process of making it for the actors was a lot of fun, because it was, walk wherever you want to walk. Don't worry about, if your back is turned, or, don't worry about where the camera is. The camera sort of functions a little more like a fly on the wall. And the script a little more, and this, makes my skin crawl as a screenwriter, but a little more as a blueprint.
Sure.
Now, I think that it varies from movie to movie. I mean, there are some of his movies that don't have that overlappy, loose feel of McCabe and Mrs. Miller or Nashville at all. In fact, this one that we're about to talk about, it has elements of those, but it feels a bit more, for lack of a better word, traditional. Yeah. Than some of his other ones. So he mixed it up, I think, throughout his career. And even Prairie Home Companion feels a little more, again, lack of a better word, composed or purposeful than, say, Nashville, which is very, kind of, as you say,
like
sprawling in a mosaic. So
well, he's the, if you were to say to me, ensemble, he's the guy.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. He's the guy that you're like, he wants to have 50 actors, you know, yeah, all above the title, all doing interesting things. I also think it's worth noting too, you know, to speak to what you were saying, Brian, about sort of the fluidity of it. The man loves a master, loves a wide shot, mm-hmm, loves mm-hmm to just sort of let things play out. And that's really lovely too. There's just, mm-hmm, there is something very, you know, we've talked about this, Kenny, obviously over the years, but like, you know, when you're in good hands, right? You, mm-hmm, you know that when you've got a filmmaker who is confident, he knows what he's doing, they know what they're doing. It's, and to sort of rewind to what you guys were saying too, like, take swings. Obviously, not all of his movies worked, but yeah, like, even when you sit down and press play on Popeye, it's a thing, and it knows what it is. You know,
I love Popeye. Yeah. Yeah, what I will say too, I think, and this is a part of everything you're just talking about, his movies are all about environment.
Yes.
You know, even the ones that I can't stand Prêt-à-Porter, but I remember the environment of it. He's as good as maybe anyone ever was at presenting a world. Mm-hmm. And so the art direction in all his films is very, you know, evocative and rich. And in this one, indeed, even though this is, again, one of the smaller ones, mm-hmm, the world of that town and of those houses is so
he sets a stage really
beautifully presented. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So, Brian, had you seen this one?
Yeah. I saw Cookie's Fortune in the theater in 99. I was already a big Altman acolyte, and this was 99, as I've mentioned in previous appearances. This is smack dab. I'm in the middle of college in New York, living across the street from two great cinemas, one of which is no longer there. The Lincoln Plaza Cinemas is the one that's no longer there. Rest in peace. So I saw just about everything.
I remember that movie. I think we discussed this before, but that was cool. Very much, very well.
Oh, it was one of the
I mean, the other one, I assume, is Sony Lincoln Center, right? So
yeah, which is still there. Yeah.
So you had every major studio movie, and you had every major indie
and every art house movie.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. I mean,
But what I can't remember, and maybe you can answer this, Phil, from your research. I can't remember if this was an Altman that played the art houses or got the big release.
I mean, this got a big release.
It's got
I'm trying to remember.
I mean, for an Altman movie, you know.
Big for an Altman movie. I'm trying to remember. Bear with me.
Who put it out? I can't remember. I just watched it.
October Films put this out.
Okay, so that's an indie.
Which is small, so it's pretty. And this premieres at Sundance in January of 99. So
this might have been in the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas then.
This is probably a smaller movie. Yeah.
What an interesting career. If you really think about it, what an interesting career. Because people, you know, I mean, he's talked about like he's John Cassavetes. But he doesn't have a career like John Cassavetes.
No.
What he did in the 70s was one of the most significant studio directors there was, working with movie star after movie star after movie star. It's not like Nashville's peopled with random people. Nashville's people with some of the biggest stars in the world. So, and true.
And some of those movies are, I'm sorry, Kenny, some of those movies are blockbusters, unlike
blockbusters and blockbusters, high budgets, nominated for Oscars, actors nominated for Oscars. It's an interesting non-Cassavetes career if you really think about it. And he had this, very Hollywood-centric 70s.
Totally.
This 80s that you were talking about, Brian, where he almost made
bumpy 80s,
but I mean, to Brian's point, and I think, you know, to Alton's credit, it's almost like he wasn't trying to do. It wasn't like he failed. It was more like he was like,
I got to take my. He's like, I got to take myself out of this for a while because the kind of stuff I do is not. They don't want to do.
Yeah,
you know,
like, there's in the 80s. I'm just looking at like the distributors of his films in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just. I guess my point is, he rides kind of a crest in the 90s of quote unquote independent American cinema, right? So
100%.
So he gets
almost like a grandfather.
Absolutely.
Actually, a lot of that came from PTA. really.
Yes. Yes.
You know, well, yeah, basically sure. holding him up as this is the man I want to be in a lot of ways. And I
well, certainly, especially at the end.
Yes. Yeah,
the
end. That second run. Yeah.
I mean,
you know, and after
literally
short,
was on set for Prairie Home Companion because Alban was
okay,
so
something
old.
Happened. Yeah.
But I think insurance.
Yeah. And, you know, and after Shortcuts really was a template for a lot of what, you know, a certain type of indie director was doing, PTA and Wes Anderson.
I mean, Magnolia and fucking Shortcuts are obviously companions.
They're the friends. Oh, they're yeah. friends. Oh, they're, yeah. they're Prairie Home Companions. But, you know, another guy who had a very similar career, Brian, is Sidney Lumet. Because Lumet also sure. had this killer 70s where yep. he was, you know, very in demand Hollywood filmmaker and working with big stars, not Oscar nominations, big budgets, and had kind of this, you know, rough 80s. And this he had a weird 90s and then had, you know, came back. But when we did our Gloria episode, we also noted that that in the early 2000s, he went to TV.
Yes,
and sure. did I believe the show is called Center Street, right? Or
yes, I think so, something like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes. And he went to TV and kind of found an avenue, an outlet that was, you know, Hollywood adjacent. And I think mm-hmm. they both kind of had this same thing. I wonder if Lynch kind of felt the same thing, which is I don't have to exactly leave yet, but I need some other, you know, way to accomplish what I want to accomplish. And then The Player. I don't think in any way Altman's the obvious director for that material. Yeah. But in retrospect, someone who was in the system, out of the system, and now probably resents the system is the perfect guy.
It's also a guy who, I mean, The Player is like, I love The Player. I think it's a phenomenal film. I really do want to rewatch it. It's a sharp movie. It's obviously a satire for sure. And, you know, and Kenny, with you having obviously worked on Entourage, it's interesting how people thought there's a lot of people that tagged Entourage as The Player, which it's not. Like, I don't think it's a skewering of Hollywood.
I
really
wish that's well, I
mean,
wish
it
that's
sort
what
of
we're
skewers
doing,
Hollywood,
but
like, not really.
No, like, we're.
No, there's no affection for Hollywood in The Player.
That's my point. Yes, I mean, there's affection for it in Entourage.
The Player thinks Hollywood is a hellscape.
Hellscape,
and there,
yes.
And there is no God, and it's all, there's no art, there's no integrity.
I mean, the final shot of The Player, it's, of the kids saying, na, 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 of him, I mean, like, getting away with it, and, like, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, which is why I love it was feted with Oscar nominations.
We got him back. I mean, of course, we fucking hate ourselves. I mean, I think the spiritual heirs to The Player in terms of like the Hollywood stuff. I mean, specifically Larry Sanders is like the big one, you know, which feels very much in that like this is all a big fucking joke. Like this
on the stars playing themselves in cameos thing. I think that is real. You know, I mean that's a big. I mean, that's my favorite part in The Player. When he kind of runs into Malcolm McDowell at a party, and
McDowell's like,
"By the way, you. Next time if you want to insult me, do it to my face, Gordon."
Yeah, I love that too. I also just love that insult. I mean, we see this in 99 movies all the time. You have all these stars in 99 movies who are still super relevant today and look the exact same.
Yeah.
Malcolm McDowell, 1971, played a fucking 18-year-old. In 92, in The Player, he looks 1,000. Like, no.
Well, yeah, that is a fun thing about The Player is because he'd been out of it for a while, a lot of the cameos are out of date. Really?
Well, that's true, too. Sure.
I mean, it's like, look, there's Karen Black. And you're like,
yeah, okay,
cool.
You know, that's kind of charming about it.
I love that about it, yeah.
But real quick, just because I suspect what it was in terms of his comeback, and I think you could probably find a few other filmmakers where this happened as well, is in the 90s, like everything else, every 20 years you start, you know, like for right now, we're all obsessed with the 90s. Like the kids are into the 90s now.
They are.
In the 90s, that
was have you seen their pants?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, yeah, it's insane.
It's a nightmare. So, the 90s, tutorial nightmare.
In the 90s, it was the 70s. You know, the 70s was...
Yes, I remember that too.
...was getting appreciated, and the 70s filmmakers were being appreciated. And those 70s filmmakers that didn't kind of transition seamlessly into the 80s, like Spielberg, were afforded comebacks, as you say, because their sensibility could jibe with that 90s indie cinema thing. Yeah. And what's interesting about Altman is Altman was, while he came up in terms of being a major filmmaker in the 70s, he was older than a lot of those guys then. Like, yes, he was older than Spielberg, Bogdanovich, Coppola, because he'd been in television for a while. So he was sort of an elder statesman rebel in two generations, weirdly enough.
Totally.
Yeah, but I'm always fascinated by these guys that come up in television, which especially then in the 50s and 60s is very structured and Lumet, very machine, like Lumet, like Richard Donner, and then emerged with completely different kinds of, you know, sensibilities. Like, they had the tools. Peckinpah is another one. Like,
sure,
they had the tools to make the machine stuff, and then they absorbed all that stuff and then blew it up. Well, but then there's still technique. You know,
it's interesting too, because, like, you mentioned this earlier in terms of kind of, you know, let's just say a loose way of approaching filmmaking, right? In terms of, like, the way he worked with actors, the way that the script was a little bit more of a blueprint, whatever the case might be. That's antithetical in its own way to television, right? As we all know.
Absolutely.
Like, so it is interesting to see how Altman sort of took what he learned, the lessons he learned in television, and then kind of sort of bent them to his will in order to create a really sort of interesting, almost Mike Lee way of making films, completely different in terms of the fact that he was clearly a genre guy in a lot of ways, too. Like, he liked, I mean, he wanted to kind of almost in a Kubrickian way break apart the genre, come at a Western and make a completely, you know.
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah. He does so many different kinds of movies throughout his career. Absolutely right. Yeah.
It is. And that's why, like, this film in particular with Cookie's Fortune, which is sort of, it's funny, as I was watching, I was like, it's sort of a mystery. It's sort of a soap. It's sort of a commentary on, it's got kind of a noises off backstage kind of thing going on too with the play. It's really kind of a mishmash of a bunch of different things, which makes it really kind of fascinating. And it's interesting too, because, like, the film that precedes this is Dr. T and the Women, which I think is one of his worst films, quite honestly.
Dr. T's right after.
Oh, yeah, is it right after this?
It's after. Same, okay. same writer.
Wrote both. Dr. T is bizarre. I saw that in the theater. I remember seeing that.
Yeah, I've actually never seen Dr. T.
It's an F cinema score movie.
Yeah, it's a rough movie. But it's also, I mean, I don't know that it's, should it have been an F cinema score? I don't know if it's that bad, but, like, I'm just saying it's interesting. But this film, I think, is a pastiche of a bunch of different stuff, which I do think is really fascinating. Let me give a little bit of a context.
Yeah.
After learning that her aunt, an elderly Mississippi widow, has taken her own life, Camille, played by Glenn Close, hatches an unusual postmortem plan with her sister, Julianne Moore, in tow. Camille hides evidence that points to suicide, deciding instead to make the death look like a murder. Her scheme, fueled by vanity and greed, is not victimless, as it appears that a local handyman, played by Charles S. Dutton, might take the fall for a crime that never occurred. Cookie's Fortune opened on April 2nd, 1999, against The Matrix, 10 Things I Hate About You, The Out-of-Towners, Forces of Nature, and Analyze This. It would go on to make $10.9 million on an $8 million budget.
That's a lot of money.
I was going to say, right?
Wow.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Like,
wow. Every time I do this fucking show, you read those kind of stats, and I'm like, oh, God, wow.
Things are different. Yeah.
It's a nice little movie.
It's a nice little movie.
$10 million.
But, and up against, like, some fucking heavy hitters.
How does this...
There was room.
I don't even know. I mean, I don't even know. Whatever.
Wow. But it's got 86% of Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 65% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 4 stars, which is interesting.
Right.
This is a 4-star movie. Cookie's Fortune is the kind of comedy with a lot of laughs and even more smiles. The cast blends so smoothly you can believe they all live in the same town. There's great warmth at the center of this film. Altman's films are sometimes criticized for being needlessly enigmatic and elliptical, for ending at quixotic moments, for getting too cute with the asides. He does sometimes commit those sins, if they're sins, but in the service of creating movies that are original, Cookie's Fortune has no ragged edges or bothersome detours and flows from surprise to delight at the end when just desserts are handed out. It arrives at a kind of perfection. Sure. 4 stars is, I mean, as Kenny, I'm sure would agree. No. As we've obviously, we talk about Ebert's reviews. There are just times when Ebert's just happy to sit in a movie with a bunch of movie stars and a filmmaker that he likes, and he's probably just a little too kind to that film.
Plus, he was the first to say he thought the star rating was stupid and that too, imposed on him by his publishers. And
sure.
So if he had a great night, he gave it 4 stars. That felt like four stars, so.
Throwing out 4 stars is great.
Sure.
I like that. Just in general, throwing out 4 stars is great. not to do a WWE detour, but I'm going to do it real fast.
Oh, wow.
There's a very famous WWE wrestling journalist.
Okay.
Who for years and years and years has been rating matches for 40 years. And it was always 5-star matches were his highest matches. And if you got a 5-star from Meltzer, it was a very usual thing. And, he'd only given out like 20 over the last 40 years. And all of a sudden he gives out a 5.25 stars. And he responds. He said, "I never said there was it was 5 with the top. And I never said it." So I like the idea.
Went up a little bit
because it's now all he's giving now he's giving now he's giving out 6 stars here and there. I like the idea. That at some point Ebert might throw out another 0.25 star. Who knows what's going to happen? I never said it was out of four. I just this is how
I think he would have appreciated that. It's funny, Phil, when you read that synopsis of the story.
Yeah.
There's a version of that that's really dark and disturbing and a thriller. And one thing that I found kind of it's funny. You asked if I'd seen it before. I saw it in 1999. Not to skip to the end of the episode, this is the rare case where I feel exactly how I felt about it.
Sure.
In every way.
Yep.
Then. When I watched it in 99, like it's exactly which is fine. What I appreciated about it then and now, and what's kind of unusual is how it's a really high stakes situation and it couldn't be more low stakes the way it's played, which is, I think, what's funny about it. Like, that's the joke, is they're all in jail playing Scrabble and, there's he has an alibi. It's very clear he didn't do it. It's very clear they will figure this out. Mm-hmm. Even apart from the fact that you're watching a movie and you know it's going to work out, the characters know it. Ned Beatty's like, he didn't do it. Like,
there's an incompetence to the police department as well, where you're just like,
I want to say one thing that I really loved about this movie that may, that actually may not be necessarily in its favor in the grander scheme, but what I believe this movie does and Altman was doing was playing with our preconceived notions of the message movie. And it's it's a little nerve-wracking to me watching a film where you have a black man, one of the only black people in this movie, accused of a crime set up by a wealthy white woman. And I do think you are, at least I was, a little afraid. And I wasn't, it wasn't until the end of the movie when I'm like, oh, this movie's great. Because I was a little nervous the whole film that Charles S. Dutton was going to go down for this.
Yeah.
And the tone of the film was like, it felt like, this is just a thing that happens. And I sometimes, one, I want my movies to be movies and not be messages. I want to be able to actually have fun and feel better about the world. And two, as Phil knows, I love a movie where everybody in general is trying to be the best version of themselves.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's what I think is happening in this movie, where, the cops are trying to be the best versions of themselves. And Courtney B. Vance, who's obviously great and everything he does, is trying to be the best version of himself. So Julianne Moore proves to be the best version of herself. And, the villain is the villain. Glenn Close
gets her comeuppance.
I understand where she's coming from. Reputation was probably the only thing she ever worried about her entire life. Mm-hmm. So I get that. That's obviously reputation is a massive thing among wealthy people in the South. I really liked it. And I do think that, if at least for me, there was this undercurrent, the entire film of, this is the South, a black man accused. I've seen fucking To Kill a Mockingbird. I know what happens. And thank God it didn't happen in this film. So
I will say, though, at the end of this film, I did ask myself, did the punishment fit the crime? In terms of Glenn Close,
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, what was the punishment?
Well, she went to jail forever.
Went to jail for
murder. Murder.
Oh, because Julianne Moore
puts her in jail for murder. I mean, that's where the black.
Yeah, no, it fit the crime. It fit the crime.
Well, I mean, she was horrible. Her. The thing is, I think when you add up in the rules of the movie, the totality of her crimes, not just the fact that she is immediately aware that Charles Dutton could go to jail for this and doesn't stop it.
Sure.
But the fact that, you know, what she did to her sister and what she did to Liv Tyler. I think just to be very clear.
Bad person,
scourge
not
on the
in
town.
Any way riding for Glenn Close. Scourge not sure she should go to jail for murder for the rest of her life.
But you know what? You know what?
I bet in a week they work it out. I bet in a week they work
probably
it out.
Probably true.
Ned Beatty will fish with her. Ned Beatty will be fine. I fished with her. I mean, it's a good point, Phil. It doesn't fit the crime, but like, who cares? Fuck her.
I mean, it's also just like, I think what's great, and not to be fucking talking about the ending, but whatever. I just, there's something about Julianne Moore's performance in the end.
Oh, yeah.
That is, I mean, first of all, Julianne Moore, obviously great actor and great in Altman films. But like, you do get the impression that this is years and years of build up. And she's just like, fuck you. I'm done. You're going to jail.
Yeah, this is the Southern Gothic. Like,
yes.
Again, like if you were to describe some of the trappings of this, it sounds like, you know, August Osage County or a Tennessee Williams thing where it's big melodrama. And what I appreciate about it is also what makes it just a nice movie, but not a masterpiece.
Yes.
Like there's a version of this you could do that could kind of really engage with all this stuff we're talking about in maybe a more real way.
Sure.
This movie is not interested in doing that. This movie is just a story. It's like, did you hear that one about Cookie, the lady who shot herself? Yep. And her aunt tried to cover it up. Like it's sort of just a nice little yarn. And totally. I kind of appreciated that Altman, who made plenty of big, profound statement movies, occasionally just wanted to, he befriended this writer Anne Rapp, who had been a script supervisor for decades. And she was pitching him short stories she wrote. And he's like, I want to make a movie of one of these short stories. And he does, you know, I like how unpretentious it is. You know,
I think I agree with you completely. I think that's a perfect word for it. I think it's a great part of Altman. It could never happen today because barring a few notable examples, these huge, bold name directors need to make every film a marquee event.
Right. Yep. They can't just make a little movie like this.
Could you imagine? It's so hard. I think about this very obviously Altman inspired. He's the fucking song from Popeye, Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah.
Punch Drunk Love is a small movie, but even that had this veneer of like, this is Paul Thomas Anderson's next thing. Well, and he also went to Hawaii and it also had sailors.
Licorice Pizza is at its heart a very simple little story that doesn't mean anything, but it's presented because he just can't not. And I like that movie a lot, but Anderson just can't not present everything on an epic scale.
Sure.
But he almost has to.
Not a criticism.
I think you're right, Phil. I think the studio wanted it, needed it. Absolutely. I think that's how you market a Paul Thomas Anderson today. I think you're right, Brian, that he can't not present it on a big scale. I think the story of one's childhood, we're seeing it now with every director, essentially. I think Licorice Pizza falls into that, you know, Fableman's Roma kind of, Armageddon time thing is the new way to tell an epic story for a director. I couldn't conceive of, and I'm going to reference someone who I don't normally reference on this podcast. I couldn't conceive of someone doing the Beyonce, let's just drop it thing. Let's just drop it without telling anyone about it thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's kind of how this feels. And as I recall, it's kind of how it felt. Like this was one, I have enough of a memory of it where it was released. This is the new Robert Altman movie. It's here in theaters, but it wasn't presented as, this is the heir to shortcuts or Some of them are presented that way. Gosford Park was absolutely presented as this is the new masterpiece from Robert Altman. This was, oh, here's a Robert Altman joint. You know, these actors are in it. Come see it. And people did, clearly. And
another director, you know, not often mentioned on this podcast, but I think it's worth mentioning for this moment, is Woody Allen. Oh, is there a person right now?
A lot more like a Woody Allen movie. That's true.
Well, it's more like Woody Allen, because Woody Allen would do that exact same thing where, you know, he'd make 10 movies a decade. Occasionally, you'd have a Blue Jasmine at a Midnight in Paris, and then you'd have, you know, Curse of the Jade Scorpion, and no one would care. And I think he, you know, he'd wash his hands of it and move on. And are there directors right now who are making movies at that clip? And some of them are big, and some of them are small, and some of them, you know,
I don't think the market supports it. I mean,
outside of probably horror directors that, you know,
I mean,
I would say international filmmakers to some degree. I mean, I
don't know if it's still happening, but yeah, you know, I mean, who did Audition?
Takeshi Miike.
So Miike makes 20 films a decade, and some of them are auditions, some of them you never heard of.
Right. But in terms of Mike Lee makes
a lot of movies.
Mike Lee makes a lot of movies.
He does. Yeah. He does. But he like Woody Allen managed to carve his own little universe where he could just do that. You know, and really Altman kind of did too. I mean, I was just before we spoke today, I was looking at the filmography, and I was reminded of how prolific Altman was. I'd forgotten that. Actually, he very rarely took big breaks between movies. Only did at the end, I think, because he was ailing. But even then, you know,
Two, three years, and then
Pair Home Companions 3 years later, and that dies almost immediately after that's released. So
it's it's interesting too, because I'm thinking about like Cookie's Fortune coming out in April. Also interesting, right? Yeah. Like this is not a movie. This was clearly not an awards player as far as they were concerned. But like all of his films, for the most part, are released in the fall, because I think that, you know, after The Player, everyone is like, you know, this guy is back in the game. And it is interesting to look at, like, Gosford Park comes out Christmas, basically. It's a limited release, and then it goes wide in January of 2002.
Oh, yeah.
But Prayer Home Companion was also released, you know, deep in the fall. Like, it's just, so that Cookie's Fortune was kind of, I hate the word dumped, but kind of dumped in April is interesting. And then it makes $10 million
that money in the fall.
I think it's fascinating. I, you know, looking at his Academy Award nominations, he got an honorary award in 2006. So near the end of his life, because he passed away in 2006. He gets a Best Director nomination for MASH in 1970, Best Picture nomination for Nashville and Director in 1975, Best Director for Shortcuts, The Player, and Gosford Park. I mean, all bangers, all work. I mean, listen, I'm not a big fan of MASH. I'd never seen MASH until during the pandemic. I watched it. I didn't love MASH. It's definitely a product of its time. It's deeply misogynistic and weird. It's not really my thing, but yeah, it's just he's a fascinating guy. I also think it's worth talking about. We talked a little bit about sprawling, eccentric, strange casts of characters that he loves to have. You know, looking at the cast of Cookie's Fortune, you've got Glenn Close, Julianne Moore, Liv Tyler, Chris O'Donnell, Charles S. Dutton, Ned Beatty, Courtney B. Vance, Donald Moffat, Lyle Lovett, who got only cast in movies in My Proper Home.
And always as total creeps.
Creeps. He's fucking pretty good.
He's great.
He's so great in The Player.
He's great in Shortcuts. He's great in this. He's such a
Julia Roberts on The Player, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Which I think is hilarious.
That was a funny little chapter. I remember that.
But just an amazing, you know, I look at Robert Altman's career, obviously, but like, look at Shortcuts, for instance. The cast of Shortcuts: Andy McDowell, Bruce Davison, Julian Moore, Michael Modine, Ann Archer, Fred Ward, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Chris Penn, Robert Downey Jr., Lily Taylor, Madeline Stowe, Tim Robbins, like Tom Waits. It goes on forever. Yeah. It's that, to me, is probably his masterpiece, if I had to. I mean, again, of the movies I've seen, I look at Shortcuts and I'm like, that's the quintessential Robert Altman film. But he's a fascinating guy, was a fascinating guy. This film, I want to talk about the performances in this one for a second, because I feel like Glenn Close is great in this. There were rumors that I guess Frances McDormand almost played the role, and then or Angelica Houston. Like there were other people, but like Glenn Close is in the pocket in this role. Like she's fucking killing it.
That's so funny. She's the only performance I don't like in the movie.
Oh, really?
And I felt that way in 1999 when you mentioned Frances McDormand and Angelica Houston. I was like, oh shit, both of them would have been better.
I couldn't. Right. Well,
I don't. I think she's too big. I think she's the only one playing. Yep. She's in a comedy. I love
it's a cartoonish
love her
for sure.
Yeah. And yeah, I think right around this time she's playing both Cruella De Vil and Norma Desmond.
And
they're both there. So
that's a really good point.
And it might have been, frankly, it might have been in 99, as I felt this exact same way in 99. It's funny when you said, let's do Talk Cookie's Fortune. I hadn't watched it since I saw it in the theater.
Sure.
Remembered very little about it, but I remembered Old Lady Dies, Charles S. Dutton, The South, and I don't remember liking Glenn Close. That's what I remember, those four things. And I rarely dislike her. So this is not like I'm a huge fan of her. Huge fan. If she's listening, I love you. I'm sorry. But for some reason, I think it's just too. And it's not like it's too arch. I think some of the other performances are also obviously broadly comic. But like Julianne Moore, for instance, Julianne Moore's playing like this simple woman who's it could easily have been a cartoonish performance. And she's incredible. Incredible in this movie. Like,
yeah, loving her.
She's great. I mean, Liv Tyler is great.
Liv Tyler is adorable.
Really
in it.
Interesting. Yeah, I love that. Apparently, Altman
wonderful. You know,
Altman said that she looked too pretty with long hair, so he wanted her to cut her hair. But then I'm just like, she's still beautiful with a pixie haircut. Like she's stunning.
She's awesome. Yeah. One of my favorite scenes is the scene where she, and it's a long take that kind of zooms in and zooms out, is when she's in the jail. Yeah. Saying, I'm going to be put in this cell too. And you have to, and she's whispering to Donald Moffat and being like, actually, if you really need me to, I have a lot of unpaid parking tickets and a lot of other crimes. I'm a fugitive of justice. Like it's this crazy stream of consciousness.
It's great.
Monologue where she's going nuts and no one else there is arguing with her or putting up any fight. There's no reason for her to go this far. That's one of my favorite scenes. She's great in this movie. That's my main issue with it.
I was going to say it paints a really lovely picture of, you know, the antebellum South, to be honest. As a, you know, warm kind of takes a village kind of place. I don't normally love Glenn Close and kind of loved her in this. I think I don't know. It's funny when you say McDormand, because I don't like McDormand in let me put it this way. I don't want McDormand in villainous roles. She can play whatever she wants to play, of course. But for me, she's Marge Gunderson. I want her in heroic roles. And I thought Nomadland was a heroic role. And I think that's, you know, there's such an integrity to Frances McDormand that sometimes when she plays a villainous role, it hits me weird. Right. It kind of, you know, it hits me weird. Glenn Close is the opposite for me. So
well, it's funny.
I
think Angelica Houston would have been perfect. When you say Angelica, she would have been Houston, great. I'm like, oh, because I think she's one of the most underrated actors, actually. I think she's very
I think all of these people that we're talking about are all heavy hitters. They're all brilliant in their own way. Brian, bringing up the Cruella De Vil and Norma Desmond thing does definitely hit home for me in hindsight, looking at the performance. I enjoyed her in it because I'm one of those people where like I can get sort of hooked when an actor's having a blast. I'm having a good time. If that's a weird thing to say, but like
everyone's clearly having so much fun,
right? Like she's just, and I look at like some of my favorite Glenn Close, like I love Glenn Close in The Paper, for instance.
Oh, hell yeah.
The best.
Like, the great movie, and she's great in it. Yeah. And she's towing that line of villain, and she's doing all of it.
That's the Glenn Close that I want more of, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, you know, now she's 70, but
she's great.
Glenn, I love that movie. It's by far my favorite Ron Howard movie. Yeah. I think I want her to play real people. I think that's what I really like. Yeah. I think that it's interesting. You know, you bring up Cruella de Vil and you bring up Norman Desmond and this character, and they're all, you know, very, you know, kind of broadly drawn. And I know she can do it. And I understand that someone you go to for that kind of thing, because she's, you know, she's a Swiss Army knife of an actor, but I love her in The Paper. She's so fucking cool in that movie.
She's great in that film. She is human in that film. I think about the scene when she's having the affair with the guy and she's squeezing her skin together, and she's like, there's wrinkles in my skin. He's like, yeah, but if you squeeze anyone's skin together, there are wrinkles. That's how it works. There's something about her there's a fragility to her that's fantastic. I mean, truthfully
she also, you know, physically fights Michael Keaton at the end too.
She does.
That movie's so good. Awesome.
Yeah,
which but is also amazing. Like, I think it's worth noting as well. I mean, Patty Hughes in Damages is a character for the ages, and what she does
great
in that is unbelievable. But I'll take her.
You know, for me, of course, I'll take her in The Shield every day of the week.
She's so amazing in The Shield.
I very rarely dislike Glenn. I truly, this is one of the only times. And you know what it might be? It might not even so much be that the performance is wrong. It's that it felt then, and I felt now, like I've seen that. It's not surprising me, because she did play those notes in other notable roles. Whereas Julianne Moore in this, Julianne Moore is always the smartest person in the room in every movie she's in. Or if not the smartest, certainly the sharpest. And so watching her play someone just truly dim is so amusing. And when she launches into the, she'll be describing something and then launch into one of her speeches from Salome.
The Salome stuff for her, she is just living the life. You know, what this performance weirdly made me think of was Safe. The Todd Haynes movie.
Oh, sure.
Which is an amazing movie that she's incredible in. And I don't think she's not playing a dumb person in Safe, but she's playing a very muted person in that movie. Like a person that's just like grappling with her body and what's going on inside her head, and just having to do a lot of sort of internal acting.
Yeah.
Julianne Moore is one of those actors, and we talked about her when we did End of the Affair, Kenny, when we did our favorite Julianne Moore performances.
She's great in that.
And she's great in it.
And we'll have, you know, Magnolia coming up too.
Yes, obviously, you know, we have Magnolia. Yeah,
good 99. But
look at the range of that. Like, look at those three performances in 99. It's unbelievable.
She was so exciting. I remember at that time
how
she really was one of the most exciting actors.
She was. That's the right way to put it. She was exciting.
You know, where it's like, what's she going to do next? Like, what's, you know, she's in this, I'll go see it. Like, that doesn't really happen anymore, where it's like, they're in it, I'll go see it. I don't even know what the movie is. That's very rare anymore. And she was definitely at that time, especially.
Totally.
I'm intellectually aware that this movie is 1999 and this is a 1999 podcast, but for whatever reason, like I keep feeling like this movie was made a day after Shortcuts, you know, like
I had no memory of the fact that it was 99. I was surprised when you told me about it, said come talk about it. I was like, oh, 99, okay.
Well, also because Julianne Moore in particular in 1999 was a massive star. This is post Boogie Nights. She's a huge, huge star. And she's playing kind of a small role in this. Now, obviously it's very pivotal at the end, but this is not a massive role. This is, you know, the kind of role you'd put Julianne Nicholson in today, where like you get a really strong actor, someone who's really good at what they do, but not someone who's like a massive star. Someone like Julianne Moore in 1994.
Right.
Yeah. You know, well, in 99, Altman, you know? In 99, it's weird.
They'll do it for Altman, and you know, and the only thing that changed really was her billing. She has the shared title card. Your name, one name is second, but slightly higher billing.
Yeah.
That's close, which you rarely see, but
it's really a good interesting one, though.
The old Spacey Jackson negotiator billing.
That's right. The old, you know, Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman and Hook billing.
or currently the Ticket to Paradise billing that we've
done. Yeah.
So what is that? Is that George first, Julia Hire?
Correct.
You got to do that. You got to do that.
Still top billed, though.
Well, it's hard to say. Right, well, I mean, you and I.
Sexist Hollywood.
You and I might have different definitions of top. For me, it's always what's higher is top.
Oh, that's interesting. To me, it's whatever's left because you're.
That's why they're doing it.
Well, it works.
So I just want to just very quickly, because we talked Julianne Moore, obviously, when we did our End of the Affair episode, but I just want to talk very, very briefly about this pocket at this time for her, because we're talking about how she was one of the most exciting people, and she absolutely was, right? And it does feel like she does Shortcuts, she does Safe in the mid-90s, she does Jurassic Park, the sequel to The Lost World, right, which was obviously a big payday and a big sort of like gets her on the map. It's Boogie Nights that's really sort of the moment, I think. She obviously gets a nomination in 97 for that. She has Big Lebowski in 98. She has Psycho in 98. She does Cookies Fortune.
She's great. She's great in Psycho.
Psycho is insane, but
oh, I don't like the movie, but she's great in that. Yeah.
But then like in 99, she's got Cookies Fortune, An Ideal Husband, End of the Affair, Magnolia. So she's got those.
Ideal Husband,
which I completely forgot she was in, Kenny. I don't know if you remember.
Four movies.
Which is pretty crazy. And then like in 2000,
I hardly remember Ideal Husband at all.
Well, those are those. Is it risible or risible? How do you pronounce that word?
Risible.
Risible. Yeah. It's one of those risible Oliver Parker bastardizations of Oscar Wilde.
It's a weird movie, but I got to tell you, we had Rochelle Lefebvre on.
Yeah,
she turned us around on it by the end.
Yeah, we liked it, all right. But there were quite a bit of movies in that vein in 99 that we did. I mean, look.
But she only has one role.
300 movies of the year.
In 2000, she is in one movie. She's in Ladies Man, which I think is amazing.
No, oh, the Tim Meadows?
She's in, yes. She plays a clown, I believe, in Ladies Man. I guess she did one day on that. Which I think is hilarious.
She took a year off. She took some time.
I'm just like Hannibal, Evolution, Shipping News, Far From Heaven, The Hours. Like it's just, and then she's one of those people that she's just in a lot of movies. Yeah. Like then she's just like in a lot of movies and she's always good. But I just, it is a fascinating 99 for her because.
No, that's a real coming out as a big star year. The End of the Affair, I remember specifically being like, wow, this is her doing life.
Yeah.
Well, because that was also, I mean, I personally think, and I think we all, I imagine we agree, End of the Affair was to be a big Oscar player.
Right.
And then she gets the nomination.
Right. When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
But the movie kind of doesn't really do anything.
No, the movie didn't really register. And I think it's a great movie.
It is a great movie.
But you're right. It didn't hit.
It was the wrong year. It was just the wrong year. It was just not in vogue in 99. Would have, fit very, very nicely into almost any other year in the 90s.
And then Magnolia is obviously such a sprawling, thing where like the only performance to get noted is Tom Cruise.
It's Cruise.
For relatively obvious reasons. But I'll say, and we'll talk about this obviously, Kenny, when we do our Magnolia episode, there are lots of scenes in Magnolia that have stood the test of time, but I feel like the scene in the pharmacy is one of those scenes that everyone kind of points to as a high point of that film. And it is walking the finest of lines what she's doing in it.
I don't want to talk too much about Magnolia because of course it's coming. Sure.
Yeah.
But she is something about Magnolia I really love. Yeah. Is it's almost like a concert where you've gotten together like 10 really incredible musicians.
Yeah.
And you were just, you know, Julianne Moore's performance for about 2 hours of that movie is almost invisible. She goes in the house and out of the house. She hires Scott. She hires Philip Seymour Hoffman. Mm-hmm. She leaves. She kind of has, you know, a perfunctory role, and then has that moment near the end with the pharmacy and the car and all that, which feels like Julianne Moore is playing her solo.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how a lot of this movie feels, is you're just same moment with Robards and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yeah.
Yeah.
To bring it back to this, you've described the best Altman movies. I mean, you've described Robert Altman's movies when they at their best. And I'm sure Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, would agree that that's who he's emulating in certainly Magnolia, but in all of his movies. I mean, that that deft handling of the ensemble. And the brilliant strokes of casting and Cookie's Fortune is like a little mini version of that too. I mean, I'm not crazy about the close performance, but otherwise everybody's got just these wonderful little moments. That little scene when Courtney Vance is interrogating the bartender and the singer at the bar. Matt Malloy as the forensics guy. That's just a little too eager.
He's so funny. I mean,
just these wonderful little and then, you know, we haven't really talked much about Patricia Neal and Charles S. Dutton, but those opening scenes,
those scenes are great.
Are so wonderful and so simple and so sincerely played that they really set the table for that. When she does end her life, you are heartbroken and her spirit kind of in the way that one should in a story like this really kind of, you know, lingers on afterward. And that's, you know, just one thing that we haven't really talked about is that he captures so well in all of his best movies is just simple behavior, you know, and just Patricia Neal living in her space and that wonderful house and the way it's lit with that stained glass window on the landing of the stairs. Like, you understand her life, you understand her relationship with him, and so even though the movie is a trifle, is sort of a little trifle and very silly, you are invested in it because of that sort of because that's sort of that first half hour that just kind of presents.
Well, I was just gonna say and that them. This, you know, the other thing that I think Altman has is patience. You know, he allows this movie to take essentially 30 minutes before Cookie kills herself.
Yeah.
You know, that's a long amount of time when you think about it. And the point of that, obviously, is so that we care about Cookie, we care about Willis, we see that relationship, we understand that relationship. You know, obviously he's informing the audience of the fact that it's a suicide. So we're never going to question whether or not it's a murder or not. Right. So we're ahead of the game for all intents and purposes, but he's fine with that. All that Patricia Neal stuff up top is really beautiful and really touching. And again, like, that comes with confidence, you know, as a filmmaker, to be able to know, like, I've got this, it's going to be fine. I'm just going to let this play out. It's going to take as long as it's going to take. I really appreciate it. There's a couple things I wanted to hit just in terms of just things that I loved Camille eating the suicide note. I mean, there's just something so
good.
That's very funny. About it.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. And again, like, despite the fact that we all agree that, like, Glenn Close is perhaps playing for the cheap seats at times, that moment, you buy it. Like, that moment, it's, you're just funny. Like, this person is a lunatic.
Well, what's great is it takes her a while to eat it, because it would.
Yes.
Right.
She's paper, literally in the following scene.
Paper's not
Julianne Moore's like, what are you eating?
What are you eating?
Yeah. that's why it's so great from the jump, because it really, in no way is this about, is it a whodunit? Is it about what's going on? It hardly even feels like, is she going to get away with it? It really is just a comedy of manners.
It's just a story.
I think we've gotten away a little bit from how much of a driver reputation can be, but that's what our protection of your reputation can be, but that's what, like, every every single period piece is about ultimately.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't think we understand. I don't think we understand or appreciate that. It's still the same story. It's, you know, once all your, you know, your Maslow basic hierarchy of needs are met, we're pretty much talking about reputation at that point.
For sure.
As a driver for drama. So
I think that one thing I will say is that sometimes Altman isn't subtle. He's sometimes and the amount of caution tape in this film is hilarious. The
caution tape budget was high.
The caution tape budget was high.
Give me all your caution tape.
Every time Liv Tyler and Chris O'Donnell make out, they're like draped in a million things of caution tape, which I think is hilarious. There's one other line that I think is worth noting. As the film comes to its conclusion, a whole bunch of shoes are dropped about who Emma, played by Liv Tyler's mom, is, because Camille was a hemophiliac, so Julianne Moore had to donate blood, and we find out that through a very convoluted and sort of sweaty scene, that Glenn Close is her mom. She learns that she's cousins with Willis, and then she says, "Which means I'm part black." And the look on Willis's face is fantastic. He's like, "Well, he's like, I'm not sure that's how this works." I think it's great.
That's a great little shot too. That little close-up shot of the two of them in the frame.
Yeah,
it really does.
He's such a king. He's the best. But I think that, I mean, just for Charles Dutton. Black? Yeah. Charles S. Dutton.
So wonderful.
He's the best. He did himself in a little bit by starring in Rock. He cheapened himself, and Rock isn't a bad show.
But I thought Rock was sort of, in my memory, Rock is what made brought him to screens. He was a theater actor, and
he
got like most of his movie work because of Rock. Am I crazy?
I don't know.
I don't remember ever seeing Charles S. Dutton in anything until Rock, because he was doing August Wilson plays and stuff. And
So Rock is 91 to 94.
Yeah, and the cast of Rock is the Broadway cast of The Piano Lesson given a sitcom.
Yeah, no, it's a great actors, and I love Rocky Carroll, and I love Charles S. Dutton. Yeah. And I think it's cool, but I also think he becomes Rock in a way that was hard to shake throughout the 90s. And I think
That could be. Yeah,
that's probably
And I would say, you know, I mean, to me, the obvious, you know, kind of spiritual heir. He is the obvious kind of spiritual heir to James Earl Jones, right? A massive theater actor who kind of made his way over to film at some point, a black man, obviously. And I don't know. I think if James Earl Jones did a, you know, Great White Hope TV show on, a secondary channel in the 80s, I don't think that would have helped. And I think, you know, look, you take the opportunities when they come. And Rock was successful, and Rock also did, you know, by the second season they were doing all their shows live. Well,
they were doing the live shows, because they were all theater actors, and they were like, "We can do this live."
And it was a cool thing, but I don't think, you know, on Fox in the 90s, it was seen as such. I think it was more seen as, "Oh, this is a show that airs after Married with Children. Why isn't it grosser?"
Well, here's the thing. Yeah, it should have been. The problem is, it was on Fox. It was actually Rock was actually like a show. It was like a Norman Lear-esque.
Yes, it was very much
dramedy with non-star theater actors on. Yeah, Fox,
he was
after
blue collar. He was a sanitation worker. I remember. I watched it all the time. I remember. Yeah,
he like furnished the house. The joke was he was furnishing the house with all the stuff he found, you know.
Yeah.
On this garbage route, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I definitely think. I don't know. I don't know if I necessarily would blame Rock for it, but I definitely think he's an actor who. I wish he had his heyday there for a while, where he was popping up in movies like this and Alien 3 and whatever.
Sure.
And then he still pops up now and then, but yes, you could certainly see, you could see him having a career like Samuel L. Jackson had that didn't happen.
Everyone knows he's an incredible actor, but it just never really popped the way I think it could have. Yeah.
And he rarely had movie roles even as big as this one. You know, I mean, he's probably the biggest part in this movie.
Sure.
If you're thinking about screen time.
I do want to rate this because we're going to do our top five Robert Altmans. And then, Brian, we'd love to hear your top 10 99s as we have asking our guests. As
you're
we
at the end,
wrap up our 99s. Wow. So I did not see this in 99. So I can't obviously rate it from then. Before this podcast, I liked this movie. I had it at a 72. And I'm actually going to go up a little bit. I'm going to go up to 78. I think that talking about this, and maybe just talking about Altman in general, has made me like this film a little bit more. I still don't think it's top tier Altman by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that it's a solid mid tier Altman. You know, and I think that for that, I'm happy.
What'd you go up to? What'd you go up to?
I went up to 78.
Okay.
So right. I feel
72 upon viewing, 78 now that we've talked.
Yeah.
About.
Yeah. Okay. That's where I'm at. What about you, Kenny?
I was actually at an 87. Okay. I was more in Ebert territory. I said, boy, what a satisfying movie. Give me satisfying every once in a goddamn while. Good guys win. Well, bad guys lose. Characters are decent. Some are smart. I like it. I really kind of can get on board with Ebert's review of it. We talk about quote unquote perfect movies often. And the fact is a perfect movie is different from the best movie or your favorite movie or an excellent movie even. And I would almost say this is pretty close to a perfect movie given what it's trying to do. I only think like if a movie like this is capable of being in the 87 range, right? I don't know how this could be anybody's favorite movie or most, you know, beloved movie or win an Oscar or anything like that. But this movie very much accomplishes what it sets out to do and more because of the alchemy of movie making. I'm going to stick it at 87. I feel great about it. And I really did love this movie. It's not quite a Limbo-esque find for me. You know, like we've had some of these movies, particularly from masters like a Sales or something that's like, oh no, this is not one of my favorite movies, but it's a good fucking movie. Yeah. Really happy we did it. Was not looking forward to it the entire pod. Go ahead, Brian.
I'm close, pretty close to you, Phil. I'd say I would have said a 72 in 99.
Yeah,
I would have said a 72.
Sure.
A couple of days yesterday, and after talking about it, and even just thinking about a couple of the scenes, as I'll bump it up to a 79.
There you go.
79. All right. I think ultimately. Yeah. The very thing that it does best is the reason it's not top tier, which is that it has no ambitions to really be anything more than a very sweet little story. And you're absolutely right, Kenny. It is a 4-star movie in terms of what it's setting out to do. But considering what it's setting out to do is kind of, I guess, kind of slight.
Yeah.
Which maybe is not fair. That's maybe why it's not top tier for me. But I'm so happy I rewatched it. It wouldn't have occurred to me probably to ever
Kenny said it best. Like, I wasn't particularly looking forward to this. Like, I was looking forward to talking Altman at some point, as it was on the list. We knew we were going to do it eventually. I'm pleasantly surprised. This movie's
a nice movie.
We've had
it's
so
on Stars.
Many
people can watch it. It's nice. Yeah. It's a nice one to throw on, you know.
We've had so many masters on our in 99 we've done so many of their lesser films, right? I mean, just one and lesser films just in terms of the public reception, not necessarily in terms of actual quality, but you know, something like Limbo with Sales, something like Bringing Out the Dead, or Hideous
mid-tier
not Hideous King, or a Holy Smoke, or we've done a lot of these movies from these, you know, a Gloria masters that just aren't, you know, their number one films. And I'm always nervous with those. I don't want to watch some great director's, you know, worst movie like ever.
Right.
And this is a good,
you want to watch a great movie. You want to watch a great movie. Departed, you know,
I'll say this.
Would the Departed make your top five Scorsese?
Oh, absolutely not. Of course not.
Good for you. Okay, would it make your top 10 Scorsese?
I'd have to think about it.
Okay. Well,
can I just say this, though? I'm glad we didn't get Dr. T and the Women for 99.
Right, because you don't want to rag on a great filmmaker. Yeah. Right.
Well, we had to with Lumet. You know, and it wasn't fun.
Yeah, I've never seen
that movie's
that.
The
not
worst.
Just Lumet.
No,
what's his face? Cassavetes. George C. Scott.
No, yeah, no, it was a Cassavetes love.
Is George C. Scott in?
It's his last
Glory,
movie.
The Glory Era.
It's his last movie,
or it's his last or second it's like to last. Close. Yeah, it's very depressing.
So, let's talk our top fives.
It's awful. It's like it's
okay, top five Altman.
Okay. I'll start right. at the bottom with my five. My number five is A Prairie Home Companion. I think a really underrated movie.
Lovely
that
movie.
I think lovely movie, and I also think got unfortunately kind of overshadowed by his passing. I feel like it's first of all, Lindsay Lohan is fucking great in that movie. People don't talk about her performance in that film, but she is great. Everyone's great. I mean, Meryl, Lily Tomlin, they're all great in it. But it's a really, really funny movie. I believe it's the movie that Paul Thomas Anderson met Maya Rudolph on as well. But I just think that it's just a really, really funny, lovely movie that... doesn't get enough love. So that's my five. What's your five?
And I think it's a perfect last movie too. It's all about death, for Christ's sake. I mean,
that is true too.
Death comes through the door at the end, literally. I mean, it's really something. It's fun. I had like a five-way tie for my number five.
Sure.
I'm gonna just have to be honest. And it's probably gotta be MASH. I've seen MASH like 50 times.
Oh,
that,
wow.
Now MASH is one. Well, MASH is one that is the opposite of your experience, Phil. I grew up watching MASH because the show was on. So it's certainly the first Robert Altman movie I ever saw. I probably first saw it when I was in middle school because it was like Smash. It was the highest grossing film of 1970 and and it became the big show. And I completely acknowledge that it's incredibly dated. I mean, misogynistic is not even the right word, but it's also, but that said, it's very fucking funny. And it is the formative Altman text in terms of kind of what he does and the fact that he was sneakily making an anti-war movie about Vietnam that they said in Korea, but really it's Vietnam. So it was a cultural behemoth at the time. I absolutely acknowledge that it doesn't, particularly the Hot Lips Houlihan subplot. And frankly, Alan Alda agreed, and the makers of the TV show kind of purposed the TV show couldn't be more different in its
they're very, very
sensibility different than the movie. But if I almost said Gosford Park, because I love Gosford Park, but if I'm being honest, I probably should say MASH because I've seen it so many times. I mean, I could quote the entire section in Japan when they're doing the surgery on the senator's kid. Anyway, Donald Sutherland, they're great.
What's your five, Kenny?
This is not fun for me because this is not a guy that I'm just naming five movies I've seen.
Let's burn through it.
My number, I'm actually not going to do it. All right, I'm going to tell you real quick.
You feel like you haven't seen enough of the?
I just haven't even come close.
Okay.
I've seen three. I've seen three that I love that would make any list.
Okay.
Do you want me to say it now?
Just do it. We'll just.
I love The Player. I love Nashville. I love California Split. I think they're all incredible films. And I think Shortcuts is really good too. Gosford Park I've seen, and I've also seen a few of the bad ones. But I don't want to really make a list because, like, really, this isn't my guy. And I really am more interested in hearing what you guys have to say, particularly you, Brian, and putting stuff on my list to watch very soon. I've already put Quintet on my list to watch. I'm looking forward to watching that.
That's an outlier, just so you know. But
it's a weird one.
I looked it up, and it's apparently about a futuristic board game where people start playing with their own lives. And I'm very into shit like that. So go ahead.
My four, Brian, is Long Goodbye. I think it's I watched it recently. It's fucking great. Elliot Gould is just it's just a great movie. It should be said too, just very quickly, because it came up as we were talking about it a little earlier. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson is so clearly inspired, I would say, by two filmmakers in particular, Jonathan Demme and Robert Altman. And I think both of those guys so beautifully navigated different genres and were able to do different things. And I remember when There Will Be Blood came out and everyone was just like, what the fuck is this? This is not what this guy does. And that to me was sort of, that was the quintessential moment where I was like, he is definitely following these guys in the sense of saying, I don't want to stay in a box. I don't want to be, you know, you could put Boogie Nights next to Magnolia and they could seem similar aesthetically. And I think he just sort of, so to me, Long Goodbye feels like kind of a quintessential, like Long Goodbye and Inherent Vice could be put next to each other. Oh, that's the point I'm trying to make.
100%. Yeah. My number four is also the Long Goodbye. Long Goodbye. Yeah. It's amazing. It's him taking the Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler novel and completely blowing it up and subverting every trope, making the him. I mean, Lebowski is another movie that's similar, where he turns Marlowe into just sort of a spaced out idiot, man out of time kind of thing. Incredible use of LA. And then the music, the John Williams song Long Goodbye, that is the only music you hear in the movie, just heard in different forms. True. It's a crazy
Schwarzenegger
movie.
Cameo.
Schwarzenegger. Oh, that has one. And it has one of the best, like, gangster, scary moments in any movie. The thing is, the movie is a great juggling of tone because it's a comedy, but it's also very thrilling. And like when Mark Rydell is the Jewish gangster, smashes the girl in the face and fucks up her face, and he's like, see, I just did that to her. I love you, I don't even like. Like, that is one of good the best. Yeah. So it's a great movie.
My number three, Shortcuts. I mean, listen, I could talk about Shortcuts forever, but I do think that Shortcuts, as I mentioned earlier, feels like the sort of quintessential Altman film. If you put a gun to my head and said, like, what's the movie that defines him as a filmmaker that you feel sort of like checks all the Altman boxes, that would probably be it for me. It's sprawling, again, beautiful Los Angeles movie, a movie that just really understands the city unbelievably well. What's your three, Brian?
McCabe and Mrs. Miller. It is one of the saddest movies ever made. It is just,
can't wait.
I mean, yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, it is basically if the player is like, there is no God, there's, you know, Hollywood is there's no hope for anyone. McCabe and Mrs. Miller is, America is a failed experiment.
Oh, yeah.
You know, using the West and the Western, as the best Westerns do, as a metaphor for kind of where we are, and certainly where we were in 71 and where we certainly are now. You know, dreamers die. But it is one of the greatest movies ever made. It is a tough one. I implore you, if you haven't seen it, to get the Criterion disc of it to watch it. Because the sound design is the muddiest and weirdest of any of his movies. And it's very off-putting to a lot of people when they first watch it. So you have to just get on its wavelength. Okay. But when you do, Warren Beatty is incredible in it. And there's no better sense of a small town, of place, than in this movie. Like, the geography of this little ramshackle Pacific Northwest Western town, and the Leonard Cohen song score that is just...
Oh, wow.
Gut-wrenching.
What am I doing with my life?
What are we doing with our lives? Never watched. You gotta watch. My number two is Gosford Park. A wonderful, wonderful movie. I remember seeing it back in 2001, and just sort of, I don't know. It's such an unbelievably brilliant metatextual kind of unpacking of the murder mystery of the upstairs, downstairs, all of it. I mean, obviously, everything that Julian Fellowes has done since is in some way or another a remix of Gosford Park.
Yeah.
But it's a truly, truly spectacular movie with just a fucking cast of just every British person that's ever lived is in that movie, it seems. So that's my number two. What's your two, Brian?
My number two is Nashville. Nashville is one of the great American films. It is certainly... It and Shortcuts are the ones that, if you think like, what's an Altman movie? Like, that's a big ensemble, finite amount of time. They both take place over, you know, 2 or 3 days.
Sure.
And Nashville, Nashville is another one that I would hold up when I say, what is the 70s? Like, Nashville just captures the zeitgeist of the 70s and of the sort of American, that turning point at the bicentennial, one foot in the mm-hmm. tradition and the other in paranoia and violence. And just talk of Kenny, I mean, what you were saying about Magnolia, I mean, Nashville to a T, like there are just scenes and sequences and moments for every one of these actors that are all on their own transcendent. And then you put them sure. together and it's frankly, it's a very overwhelming movie. It's one that I've only watched a couple totally. Times because it's almost too much. And it's not to say it's funny. I mean, it's a funny movie, but there's just, it's so much. And it is such an example of what you were speaking about earlier, Phil, about his playing with sound and sure. it requires so much of you and kind of gut punches you so many times that I've only seen it maybe two or three times, but
yeah, it's great. I mean, I could speak to this cause I've seen it and I love it. Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, it's, I was going to say it's a full meal. Right. More than almost any movie I've ever seen. Right. You do feel overstuffed after this film. I also think if it weren't for the music, it would be a lot harder to enjoy this film. Right. There's so much here, but so much of it feels like these musical respites from what's happening on screen.
Yeah. And it's country Western music. So the juxtaposition is so interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And I also like that the previous generation are not your classic fuddy-duddies, right? They're not your classic, like, they're not your classic ruling class. This is what we're talking about Nashville. We're talking about, you know, people who saw a bit of a backwards, old-fashioned idea of what America is, but their America is still fun, right? Their version of America is still fun and hopeful and exciting. It's not, you know, we wish we were still, you know, living in our boring cookie-cutter houses in our boring suburbs and, you know, eating our boring TV dinners. No, it's still vibrant. The whole thing is vibrant. And I think it's a really kind of incredible film. Yeah.
I mean, Phil,
not the first one to say that. Yeah.
You as a Magnolia fan, I mean, Henry Gibson in Nashville. I mean,
yeah, I have no excuse. I literally own the Blu-ray. It's on my shelf. Yeah. It's been given to me years ago as a
but
gift.
It's like Magnolia in that it's a lot.
I need to sit down and watch it. And I'll tell you this. I mean, this obviously this podcast is, you know, I've got McCabe and Mrs. Miller. There's a lot of Altman that I love that I've not seen that I want to kind of I want to dive into. But my number one is The Player. Mm-hmm. There was kind of no question it was going to be. It was my entry into his films. It was kind of my entry, as I mentioned earlier, into sort of the inside baseball behind the curtain of what this industry might very well be. You know, there's a line that has stayed with me, you know, over all the years. And now living here speaks so much more loudly. There's a scene when they're all sitting at a table, Griffin and a bunch of his friends. And he's like, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something along the lines of, can't we talk about anything else within this industry? We're smart people. And then there's silence, and then they all just laugh. And you're just like,
oh, yes. Oh, my God. That's incredible.
And they're at lunch.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. It really is just, you know, it's funny because LA Story comes out around this time, too. Right?
Year before.
Right. Yeah, around
year before.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And LA Story is another movie that's also taking the piss out of LA, but it's doing it in such a like, oh
but it loves LA.
Cute? Aren't we kind of
loves
funny?
LA. Yeah.
Well, it's from the point of view of a guy who's really fucking kicked LA's ass over and over again and become like, you know, and maybe that's why Bowfinger doesn't really work for me either, because there's just something about Steve Martin's view of LA, which is like, dude, you're the biggest winner in like LA history.
You're totally
like,
you're
totally, you know, well,
but I think the movie LA Story acknowledges that. I mean, LA Story acknowledges that it's absurd that this, you know, that I mean, he has Shakespeare buried in LA. You know,
I like
he visits
LA
Shakespeare's
Story,
grave at Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Yes, no, he's LA Story is funny. LA Story is a little
he's
different.
He's aware of that, but
it's such a open. I think so. Anything Steve Martin does with LA, and I love Steve Martin. In part, I think he's a great counterbalance to all the people who hate LA. But everything he does to LA kind of feels like an open mouth tongue kiss to the city.
Oh, sure.
No, for sure. I'll say this too. You know, the Bowfinger thing, feels a little, I don't want to say meaner, but there is some mean stuff in Bowfinger. Like the Heather Graham character is a little bit more kind of, you know,
we talked about this on the podcast. I don't think the movie doesn't seem aware that it is really fucking nasty to that character.
No, well, for sure.
Oh, that could very well be.
I know that you, Brian, you have a bit of a hard out, so we want to burn through your, if I'm not mistaken, did you not say that you need to be done in a little bit?
No, I'm fine. I'm good at like 12, 20 or something. But
here's with your number one, yeah.
Yes, your number one. I'm so sorry. I want to hear your top 10.
And then it's not The Player?
No.
Good for you.
Oh no. The player was tied for my number five with Gosford Park and MASH and California Split about three others. No, my number one is Shortcuts with a Bullet.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Oh, with a bullet. And now I will say, had we recorded this 2 months ago, mm-hmm. I would have probably said Nashville was my number one with a bullet. Then I went and I got to see Shortcuts at the Cinematheque at the Arrow in a 70mm.
I was so pissed. I wanted to see that so badly.
And I wouldn't have seen Shortcuts in a theater when it was released. It was 93. I did not. Home video. And I did. I mean, I watched it pretty soon after it was on home video and always enjoyed it. Mm. But saw it in this. And I mean, talk about sound design with the 70mm sound. And you might remember that the very long opening credit sequence that, again, totally emulated in fast motion by Anderson and Magnolia. But in Shortcuts, it's this sort of languid sequence where you meet all the characters juxtaposed with these helicopters that are spraying for medfly
pesticides all over
Los Angeles. And that sound design and that music, that jazz score and the Annie Ross songs that come in, that movie just, it completely destroyed me seeing it in the theater. Like destroyed me. It is such an emotional roller coaster, such a gut punch. Some stuff happens at the end that just astonishes you with its brutality, but then it's also hilarious. It's so funny. And it's one where, and this is such a good reminder. I've talked about this a little bit with our mutual friend, Clay Keller, about with Screen Drafts. Is like, movies really, they all should be seen on the big screen. I think we've all gotten used to, okay, well, I'll go see that Marvel movie because I really need to see that on a big screen. But this drama, I can wait until we get to video. And so watching this, which is a drama about people living in Los Angeles and all the scenes are in houses and yards and stuff, but it's cinema. It should be seen on the biggest screen possible. And when you've got a filmmaker like Altman who was making movies, this is as movie a movie as I've ever seen. I walked out of it like I'd seen Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, it was just
every movie
amazing.
Should be seen on a big screen.
Yeah.
We should all throw our TVs away.
I couldn't agree with you guys more. I also think it's worth noting too, you know, Raymond Carver, who writes the short stories that Shortcuts is loosely based on, was one of the greatest short story writers that's ever been. Mm-hmm. And you talk about Altman understanding the grounded human moments, the small moments and the sheer enormity of them, and the theatrical experience of seeing these lives writ large on this big screen, written from a writer who understood the enormity of the mundane. Mm-hmm. It is truly, truly spectacular. I'm so bummed I didn't get to see it.
It was really something. It's like top five theatrical experiences I've ever had. It really was.
Yeah.
It was.
I hope that.
So that's why it's kind of a cheat that that's what got it to number one, was that experience. You know, I suppose if I saw Nashville in a similar context, they'd be neck and neck. But there we go.
Let's hear your top 10 99s.
Here's my top 10. I'll do it real. I'll do
start,
it real
start
fast.
From the bottom.
No. Don't do it fast. We have to judge you. Go.
Well, I've got to find. Hold on. So I'll start from the bottom. So top 10.
Yeah.
Okay. Top 10. Number 10, Eyes Wide Shut. Masterpiece.
Good choice.
I know you all love it. The feel good movie of the holiday season. probably only number 10, probably lower than one might think, just because it's not one that I
rewatch a lot.
Watch all that much. Yeah. So
I think it's more rewatchable than you might think, but
I think it's weirdly rewatchable, actually.
I think maybe three or four times. I've seen that maybe three or four times. And most of the other ones of these I've seen in the double digits. So that, okay. I think that
fair enough.
But great movie. Number nine, The Matrix, for all the reasons.
What a film.
The Matrix.
One would assume. I can't convey, and I'm sure you've spoken about this, what it felt like to go in to see that movie in the theater because no one was talking about it. It had no hype. We probably only went and saw it because it was like, oh, well, this is playing in an hour. We've got a couple hours before our next class. Should we run over and see this thing that Keanu Reeves is in? And then you walk out and you're like,
the world is different now.
Have I just been forever changed? Yeah. Like, so
I saw it with my parents and I don't know how that fucking happened.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, but we saw it with some classmates.
Yeah. I saw it with some classmates across the street.
I think we saw it on vacation.
Oh man, it was
it was in February, wasn't it? Late March.
And I think we, I mean, I have a fairly distinct memory of seeing it in a theater that I never saw another movie in, and we all liked it. Even my parents liked it. All right,
amazing.
Those kind of movies back then never came out in March. Right. I mean, great movie. Eight being John Malkovich. Again, talking about just
the bangers at the bottom of this list. Can't wait to hear the top.
Well, no, this it's going to get weird. Yeah, I love being John Malkovich. Got nothing to say about it except for the other six, seven I like more. Number seven, this shouldn't surprise you. Julie Taymor's Titus.
Oh, I know what number one is. All right, we'll just go to number two. You don't even have to say number one. All right,
one of the greatest.
I just realized what's going to be on this too.
Yes, we love Titus. Titus is incredible. Yeah,
one of the greatest Shakespearean adaptations of all time, six.
That's another Rochelle Lefebvre episode that we had her on for. That was a hell of a.
I should listen to. I don't think I've listened to your Titus episode.
It's a great episode.
I mean, made Anthony Hopkins want to quit acting because of what she put him through. But he's one of the best performers.
Worth it.
Great movie. Criminally hard to find now. It's appalling that it's hard to find.
True.
It was on Criterion Channel for a bit. We didn't watch it on Criterion.
Yes. I have an out of print Twilight Time Blu-ray that I paid an absurd amount of money for.
Amazing.
But that's all. It's hard to find. Number six. We just talked about it. Magnolia.
Yep.
No notes. Love it. Number five. Toy Story 2. I mean, again, what do you say? It always fights for supremacy between two and three, for which is my favorite, depending on the mood. But if it probably is two, I just think two is perfect, you know. Yeah. And it was really, I remember
not close time, for me. It's three, but what are you going to do?
I just remember again. If I'm thinking about 99 too, Toy Story 2 really kind of made you sit up and go, "Oh, they're doing this with the sequel."
Yeah,
the sequel is when you're just supposed to do a bunch of bullshit. They have deepened this. Wait, is this thing about something else? Like, really, like that movie knocked my socks off. Number four, one of the great entertainments of all time, a absolutely perfect swish wash of a Hollywood entertainment, Galaxy Quest.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, I could hear it from what you were saying. Yeah,
there is. And that's one that shot up in my list the last time I watched it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just perfect. It's absolutely, when you realize about two thirds of the way through that you're actually watching a Star Trek movie, that they've brought you into a Star Trek movie where you deeply care about whether or not this alien race survives.
Uh-huh.
Fantastic. Number three, the greatest black comedy of all time, arguably Election, Alexander Payne's Election. I really want to read that sequel. I haven't read it yet. I'm excited.
You should read it. You will love it.
I'm excited. I mean, it's perfect. Again, like, I love it when I love big stakes in small places.
Yeah, me too.
And the idea that a school election is as important to the people involved as a world war is to the, you know, the world leaders and generals. Just
Election, the best.
Just the best. Number two, a movie worthy of Hitchcock, The Talented Mr. Ripley.
And that was a great list, Brian.
Number one,
Talented Mr. Ripley. Pretty incredible.
That's number two.
Can I just say one thing though about what I do? What I think is interesting. Yeah. We've had a handful of people come on in these last episodes as we've been sort of running up to the end, doing their top 10 lists. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned this a little bit earlier, Kenny, but like Ripley has shown up quite high on a lot of people's lists.
So and is Galaxy Quest.
So is Galaxy Quest.
Like Ripley has been on, I think, every list pretty much. Yes. And then yes. Galaxy Quest Galaxy has been Quest. On a bunch too. So those it's interesting. I mean, Ripley, well, those I have
ones. Those are both ones that underperformed at the time and kind of flew under the radar, but they just they hold up and they get richer and richer the more you watch them. Yep.
I mean, also Eyes Wide Shut. So I think to me, those are the three movies that over the course of this podcast, Galaxy Quest, maybe not as much, but the other two for sure. I have felt like a very strong tie behind those two movies. Galaxy Quest, I felt it a little bit before and maybe not as strong now, but people definitely love those three
Ripley,
films.
I think Ripley is just one that, because again, you look at it, as much as any movie, and you look and you mourn what we have lost. Like, it's just the artistry of that movie and the budget and the scale and the attention to detail and just the romance of it, even though it's also this chilling thriller.
It's a great choice.
It's a movie, you know?
It really is. It really is a great.
Number one, though. Number one.
Here it is.
What's number one?
The greatest movie about the theater. The greatest performance of 1999.
I can't believe you're putting Cradle Rock from, at number one, Brian.
Jim Broadbent as W.S. Gilbert, the greatest performance of 1999. A movie I just saw at the American Cinematheque in a lovely, I don't think it was a print, I think it was DCP, but it looked great in the big screen. Of course, I'm talking about the Mike Leigh's Topsy Turvy, the greatest movie about the theater, about
can
actors.
Can I ask you a question?
About writing, I want to ask him a question.
About production of a show, about what we do as artists. The greatest movie ever about that.
That's cool. So, hey, that's cool.
The best movie in 99.
We like what we
My
like.
My fourth favorite movie of all time, Topsy Turvy.
So I know you're number one because you've mentioned it many times. It's Robin Hood. And I...
The
Adventures of Robin Hood. I believe you've mentioned number two somewhere too.
Godfather Part Two.
And what's number three?
Two. Midnight Run.
Number four
is... This is a fascinating list.
I contain multitudes. Turvy.
You do contain multitudes. Here's my question to you, Brian.
No problem with your one through three.
I mean, Topsy Turvy is a masterpiece, an unassailable masterpiece.
I'll just say this because I, you know, listen, anyone who's listened to our Topsy Turvy episode knows that Kenny's not a fan. It's Topsy, it's Turvy.
Only gotten about halfway through it.
I do think though it is the episode, not the movie. I you know, watching it again when we did our episode, I did find myself I'd only watched it the one time in the theater, and I remember liking it in the theater but also feeling a little bit like I'm not sure I totally get this. And I do think that so much of it is baked into the theatrical experience, the experience of working in the theater, of being a theater actor, or you know, any theater crew as well. And I think that it is a love letter to that, and in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know shit about Gilbert and Sullivan. I continue not to know shit about Gilbert and Sullivan outside of what Aaron Sorkin has taught me. I think that. If I look at the film through that lens, less so about the actual subject matter itself, because I do think that I agree with Kenny, there's some problematic stuff in the Mikado and in some of the stuff that's going on culturally, even if it's a product of its time. I think the film is what I loved about it most was existing with this crew of people and this love of making this thing, of making this theatrical. That to me is an exciting thing.
Yes. Good.
But it's not for everybody. And listen, I will also say this too.
I don't think it should be for, you asked my top 10.
No, of course. And I'm more than anything, I just want to say that, you know, one of the things that I loved about our episode on Topsy Turvy was that it was an opportunity to be able to sort of talk about Mike Leigh as a filmmaker. And I do think that Mike Leigh is a fascinating filmmaker made all sorts of really interesting films. And Topsy Turvy, for all intents and purposes, is kind of an outlier in terms of like looking at his filmography. He doesn't.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's usually.
Definitely.
So I, you know, most of his films are about, you know, small lives, blue collar people living their lives. And I obviously love the way he makes films. I think it's really interesting, but I think it's interesting that it's here, that it's that high, not just on your list of 99, but that it's that high on your list of films of all time.
Brian, part of why we love you so much is because you're 100% yourself.
Yeah, you don't.
Nobody will talk you off of your positions. But I gotta say, no. Brian, as we're winding down the podcast, and you've been you've been at least a 5-timer, probably more.
Yeah.
And you become
I don't know if I have actually, but keep well,
you've
going.
You've been on the Patreon twice.
Been on the Patreon a few times. That's true. That's yes. True. And we're gonna do another one. So
we are
so,
soon.
Yes. Yeah. You'll be a multi-time podcast guy. One of the best parts about this podcast has been the new friends we've made. And Brian, absolutely. We consider you one of our best friends on this podcast that we've made. It's been an incredible experience. And
I feel the same way.
Thank you. And you came on early enough in this run where we were mostly just booking people we knew. Yeah. We didn't know you before this. You took a chance on us. So
Our friend Toby introduced us.
That's right. Our friend Toby introduced us. Toby and you came on and you gave it your all, and you've always been really, really, really brilliant and opinionated, and you never had to do this for us, and we love that you've come on. We love that you come on and become an important part of this podcast fabric. And I look forward to drafting against you one day.
Well, we got to do screen drafts. Yeah,
when Clay allows it.
How have we not done a screen drafts?
Because Clay only lets me draft against Phil now. He knows that no one can handle it except Phil. So
we should try to concoct one where we're up against the three of us together doing something.
Oh, I would. I mean,
like a mini mega of some kind. We need to. Phil, when are we doing? Is it now? Is it now appropriate to announce our ER episode recap podcast? Right, we're doing that, right?
Can you imagine?
Brought me
on? Oh my god! Oh my god!
A million episodes, we'd just cry the whole time. But we just cry because. So I just want to run through very quickly. You were on ER. You came on in 2019 for an ER episode where Kenny watched us cry together as we talked about things that happened on ER. You came up from Cradle of Rock, which. A fascinatingly weird, interesting movie.
Not a bad episode. Movie. I've changed my mind. Not a bad movie.
Not a bad movie. You came on, talked with me about Five Votes Down on West Wing.
Yes.
You came on again to talk about ER with me again. We talked about Great Expectations. Obviously, you come on for Cookie's Fortune. You were on for Last Crusade. And you were coming on the 2009 Patreon for Where the Wild Things Are. So people can have that to look forward to. That'll be dropping.
I'm very excited to talk to you about
that. December. I'm really, I don't know about you, Kenny. I'm really excited to rewatch that film.
Can't wait.
Me too. I haven't seen it in years. Yeah. Years.
It's a really interesting movie. And talk Spike Jones again. We talked, obviously, being John Malkovich with fellow screen drafters Adam Bivari and Mark Harris. That has dropped already at this point. But listen, Kenny said it best, and I'll just reiterate for him. You took a chance on us. You sat down in a room when we were recording live and talked about ER with us and
then could get me to leave. I was like, guys, it's
couldn't get you
out. This guy's crazy. We have to get him out of here.
You know, we've been talking about this as we wrap this up, but truly, like, we consider our guests friends now, and it's just such a joy to have you in our lives and to come on and talk about these things with us. And I'm so glad that we were able to get another 99 under our belt with you. So
thank you both. That's so kind of you. And truly, it's been such a pleasure to get to know you both. I love talking movies with you. So this has been a treat, a complete treat. And I'm excited. I'm excited for the ER recap podcast. I think it should be very easy to do.
Listen, man, me too. I got the bandwidth. You're the one that has, you know, you're trying to write things and raise children. So, you know,
No. Don't. I'm only half joking. Okay. But yeah, thanks, guys. No, this has been so much fun. And I'm excited to hear what the next few weeks. Yeah, all things are. Yeah, great.
Yep. Thank you so much, Brian. It's been a blast.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye. Bill, you watch any Human Traffic yet?
No.
The things we do for this podcast.
human trafficking? Is that
human traffic?
I wish it was about human trafficking.
We're doing for your edification, Brian. Kenny came up with a great idea where we were bringing on four of our sort of biggest fans on Twitter to do mini episodes. So we're doing human traffic with one of our fans at 9 a.m. tomorrow. So I got to watch that today.
Fan. Our best fan.
Heard of that movie? What is that movie?
It's like a British comedy.
Oh, okay. It's like, you know what, dude? It's spiritually, it's a lot like Go.
But it's like a little crime comedy.
There's not really the crime element, but it's like the rave culture thing, but a British version of it. It's not and it's very flights of fancy, and it's very, you know, these almost Family Guy as cutaways. It's no good, but this guy's the guy who built our wiki, which is insane that a dude built a wiki for us.
I didn't even know you had a wiki. I have to look that up.
The wiki is you have so a page. Detailed. I literally was. That's how I knew which episodes you came on for. The duration, their air date.
Screen Dash has one too. They're it's amazing.
You seen the section where he does movies mentioned. He writes every movie mention.
It's insane.
It's like
God
bless him. A hero.
So the least we could do is have him on. I want to pay him.
It's an incredible thing.
And quotes. You probably have quotes. He pulls quotes.
He pulls quotes from every episode. It's a pretty incredible thing. It's an amazing thing. So the four movies that we're covering with our fans are Wing Commander, Human Traffic, Adventures of Sebastian Cole, and In Too Deep. So just real bangers.
Oh my God.
We're trying to keep them at half an hour. We fell twice.
You said you'd watch them all. You're going to watch them all. God damn it.
That's right. We sure did.
All right. Anyway, well, thanks, guys. I do have to run, but that was so much fun.
Later, Brian. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.